All right, folks, welcome to the Man of Steel podcast. Yes, it's another crazy moment with the Man of Steel. I'm Michael Steele. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, all those great places, wherever you get your podcasts or anything else you may get out there. And you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Now, this week, I've been excited about this moment because you've heard him, seen him, and now we'll get a little bit up close and personal with the one and only Rick Wilson. He's a Republican consultant, Daily Beast columnist. He's the author of one of the best titles out there today. It's a great book, Everything Trump Touches Dies, A Republican Strategist Gets Real About the Worst President Ever. Rick, welcome to the house, brother.
Thank you, my friend. I'm so glad to be with you.
It is good to have you. Well, I don't even know where to begin because you've laid down so many important tracks in trying to push not just Republicans, but the country into a man in the mirror moment, if you will. Sort of take a look at who we are as Americans. Take a look at what is happening around us, what this presidency, this White House, where we are as a nation. How are you feeling right now about things, about the country, about the party? And we'll get into the book in a moment, but just sort of broadly speaking, your assessment as we get ready for, you know, Labor Day in the fall and campaigns.
Right.
How do you take stock of America right now?
Well, look, I think America right now is on this weird bubble. We're on the tail end of 9 years of quantitative easing from the Fed and a big bubble of soft Fed money underneath the economy. And we're on the verge of a trade war. We just passed a tax bill, and although you and I are both low tax guys,
right,
it's a tax bill with a price tag that required economic growth to always be around 5% forever.
Yeah.
and like I said, and a trade war is looming. So I think we're on the one hand, we're at the cusp of an economic moment that is not going to be pretty. I suspect that our party is going to get blamed for this economic moment. And on top of all that, we're cruising into the fall elections where with the economy's numbers where they are, we should be sitting back and eating barbecue every day and not in a panic about losing potentially, you know, 50 plus House seats. But there we are, all because of Donald Trump's numbers with the rest of the country outside of the shrinking Republican base.
Right.
You know, so as far as I feel about the country, we are on the cusp of chaos. And it feels like we're always on the cusp of chaos, but it feels like it particularly right now.
Well, yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense because if you're going to define a period of time that has all the elements that this time has, starting the 2015-16 primary cycle to the present day, the one operative term that really kind of fits and defines it all is chaos. And in fact, if you think about where Steve Bannon and Reince and the president were as they were setting up this operation, what was the one thing, especially Bannon, made clear when they had their little tete-a-tete during the inauguration week, and that was deconstructing the administrative state.
Yeah,
that's ultimately about creating chaos within. It's not just about the institutions of government, but it is about how we value those institutions, how we look at each other as Americans. And so you're right. It creating that chaos scenario makes a lot of sense in sort of a definitional way.
Yeah. And I do think that this is a president who thrives on, you know, it's a guy who knows he's going to get himself in trouble, and he thrives on, you know, setting one fire to get away from the last fire. And
right.
So, you know, that's one of the reasons that the country and the White House particularly feel very unstable all the time. And why, you know, as you see Omarosa's firing and the drama around it, this entire desire to make everything into a reality TV show moment drags us into these positions where I think we're less strong and less resilient as a country. And unfortunately, I think that, you know, they have become so definitional to Trump's brand and to Trump's form of leadership. I won't say leadership, I'll say form of leadership.
Right.
That, you know, we're going to have to ride this pony as long as he's in office.
And this pony only has two and a half legs at times. that's 90% of the problem. We're dragging the pony along more than the pony is giving us a ride.
You know? Yeah, that is so true.
Which is why, you know, I sit here, and that's a great analogy for Republican leadership, which I consider on its best day to be feckless. and on its worst day to be complicit in creating and sowing those seeds for the chaos. What I have yet to figure out, maybe in your wisdom, you've been a campaign operative, you've been a political consultant, you know how to, you know, craft the message in the ads that you've done in the past. So what is it about the Republican leadership, and I put quotes around that term leadership, that we find that they can't find the bone or the balls to openly oppose the president on some very basic stuff that are fundamental to our core as Republicans, but then even more broadly, when you look at a Charlottesville or you know, trying to alienate an entire religion from coming to the country, why are they so complicit in their silence?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of the, a core part of the Trump brand is also division. And so that is why he is always seeking to call out people, you know, and I hate to use the sort of politically correct terminology of other, but he's always calling out the other. It's always, you know, the NBA basketball players or the Syrian refugees or the Mexican children. And unfortunately, there is a part that, and I wrote about this in the book, there's an ugly part of this we have to kind of admit was always in the hidden away in the basement of the party. And now those people are out in the light and they love it. That's what they thrive on with them.
Rick, you hit on something that I've been saying for a while now, because it really relates back to when I first got involved with the Tea Party during the 2009-2010 cycle. And one of the things beyond the anger and the frustration that they had at that time, there was this sense of a lack of trust and expectation from the party and its leadership. And so they have grown weary and tired of that. They saw what happened in the Bush years with the big government republicanism, the spending, the explosion of the debt and deficit and all of that. Trump comes along, he pricks that scab, reopens those wounds, and puts his own brand of salve on it, if you will, to sort of heal it, but heal it in the form of Trumpism. And what has struck me is that no one kind of realizes that, A, that's not a Band-Aid. B, that salve in the end is not good for you. It actually is toxic to your system.
Right.
And C, what is the expectation when this is all done? I mean, our Constitution, unless there is a real upheaval and things change and Donald Trump gets a third term, this too shall end. So what's left for conservatism, republicanism, as not just a brand or a party, but as an idea that people are attracted to?
That's, and you know, to loop back on one of your prior questions as well, all these leaders in Congress, and you and I both know these guys, who were absolutely going to do entitlement reform and absolutely going to do budget reform and absolutely going to keep us on track fiscally, and who believed in smaller government and limited government, you know, they have abandoned that because they're afraid of this man. They're afraid of Donald Trump.
Why?
They're afraid of the fact that when
is his bigger than the rest of us? I mean, does he walk around with a schlong the size of New York? I mean, what the hell are we afraid of?
Well, that's been my question from the beginning to these guys is, what are you afraid of? What's the worst thing he's going to do? He's going to tweet at you?
Yeah.
I mean, oh my goodness, a Twitter feed. How deadly. You know, and look, yes, when Trump tweets at somebody, their lives get flooded with trolls and cranks and death threats and all that stuff. But the reality is, you know, these guys aren't in Congress to be like junior managers at a Trump gift shop.
Right.
They're supposed to be out there representing their states and their districts and upholding their oath to the Constitution. And if they can't be trusted to do that, it becomes really difficult for people to say, oh, yeah, you're going to stand up when it really counts. You were afraid of a tweet and now you're going to stand up for me. And so, you know, I think the future is kind of grim, Michael, because none of these guys in Congress today, even the ones who think they're playing a super crafty game,
right,
you know, that are out there like, I'm going to praise the president. When he's gone, we can fix the party. No. This is like, I'm going to let the guy, my best friend from college who just got out of prison, stay on my couch for a few weeks while I'm on vacation.
Right.
It never works out like they think.
And, yeah, because 8 months later, he's still there, and he's now
right.
He's now
he's either still there, or you come back and the place is empty. One of the two. And so I think this expectation they've all had for a long time is, oh, well, you know, we can secretly shift him. If we kiss his ass, we can make him do the right thing. And none of these guys, it doesn't ever work. And I mean, look, you look at Lindsey Graham and my friend Marco and Ted Cruz and everybody else, and they'll go in and say, I'm going to get Trump to do X or Y, do the right thing. And he may even say, sure, when they're in the room. And then the next morning when he's taking a dump on the White House toilet, he's out on his Twitter feed blowing everything up. So they can't ever win by trying to change somebody who basically lives in the immediate moment. Trump is a creature of just his impulses and his urges and whatever's in front of him at that particular second. So it's a very difficult spot for him to be in.
Well, and because of that, I just don't see a good ending to this scenario, because I think you put it aptly, if you're afraid of a tweet, what the hell are you going to do when that space is gone and you're left like, you know, in one of those horror movies with this wasteland, you know, the zombie apocalypse has now occurred, and you're sitting there with all of these Trump zombies coming at you. And what are you going to do then? How are you going to take care of all of that and write the party in a way that it moves forward? You know, a lot of people, you know, our buddy Steve Schmidt and a lot of these folks are peeling off. I understand that. And I say to them, you know, for me, the fight is still worth it on the inside, because I want to fight for not just what's left, but there were reasons why I joined the party. And yes, it's harder and harder every day to stand in the face of stupid and justify sticking and staying in the fight. But at the end, is it worth it? The question I have for you, is it worth it for you?
Well, you know, I jokingly told Politico, in some ways, there are days I stick around just to be an extended middle finger.
Yeah, that's me. I agree
and to
that.
Remind them and to be there, to be that guy that keeps saying, hey, you know that uncomfortable feeling you're having? That's your soul trying to get back in your body.
Perfect.
It's, you know, you can stay. You know, and Michael, as much fun as I had writing this book, and people who listen to me and read my stuff, they know I'm a smartass.
Right.
And this is not a dry political tone. This is Rick Wilson balls out, which is, you know, pretty much my default setting. And
yes, it is.
I'm not even sure I have another setting.
No, I've never known you to have another setting. No.
but I mean, I do touch on it in the back end of the book, talking about, you know, when we're past this moment, what do we need to do? And I think a lot of it, we have to have some really hard self-examination. And that's about a lot of things, both policy-wise and about a lot of things, both, the character of the party. I mean, I know you don't, and I don't want to be part of a party that has any, even the slightest window of daylight for people like the alt-right and Richard Spencer to think, and David Duke to think, okay, those are our guys, they just can't say so. I want them to know that our Republican Party is a long, extended go-fuck-yourself to them.
That's it.
That's a bottom bright line. And unfortunately, you know, we had people who last year came out in Congress and said, oh, well, Charlottesville was bad and it was awful. And then it was next day right back to business with this president.
Yeah.
And not even a moment.
And that's what was so sour about that. And then they run around thinking that black folks, Hispanics, women are going to suddenly go, oh, yeah, we ignore all that and we're going to support you and your brand of Republicanism. You touch on the book, and this is a great way to sort of get into this book, because the title doesn't do justice to what you say and do in the book, to be honest. But I want to set it up this way, because you were on Morning Joe, and you caused that team to do something they hadn't done in a long time, and that was to hit the 7-second delay. We're going to take a quick listen to that clip, because it is a priceless Rick Wilson moment.
Look, there's a bigger Never Trump movement out there. There's just a huge courage deficit in this country.
Are you saying that on TV?
But these guys call us and they express these unbelievable, this disgust with Trump. They're not all bought into this. In the House, there are probably 40 or 50 guys who are completely on board with Trump and Trumpism. So,
Yeah.
Wow.
So
okay, then.
Let me just say, hey, Rick.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Listen, you owe me maybe a dinner next time I come.
A very large dinner, Joe.
Because of my past failures, and of course it happens every day, we had to implement a 7-second delay. So what you said will probably not make it out there.
So for those of you who didn't get the bleeps, let us be clear about what one Rick Wilson said live on national television. Quote, I said Washington is full of profiles and chicken shit. You and I, talking to Joe Scarborough, you and I both get calls from members of Congress who say, I can't stand this asshole. End quote. So I understand why they bleeped you. But there's a lot of truth to what you say. And you touch on that in the book, Everything Trump Touches Dies. Tell us about the book and where you're going. I love the dark humor in it. You've always had that sort of like, here's a knife. I'm showing it to you now. Here, feel the knife as I bring it to you. Get into the book a little bit about this quote and how it really relates to what you lay out in the book.
Sure. I mean, look, the funny thing about that whole interview was that's pretty much like any other conversation with me. and there were a bunch of folks who are, you know, from some various Trump supporting media outlets who immediately started to run for their fainting couches and get their smelling salts. And they described it as an obscenity filled rant. I'm like,
I saw
that. Think the word chicken shit and asshole delivered calmly as a rant, you ought to come by after I've had a couple of bourbons. But no, I really, this book is one where I am willing to go after the sins of our own party first, mm-hmm. because this was a leadership failure on our part. This was a leadership failure inside our own party. And we sat on the sidelines for far too long. And then once he was in office, we normalized every bit of his behavior. And it became a monster we helped to breed and build up. And now that it's running wild in the world, it's much harder for us to stop. And so, you know, I am direct. I am blunt. I call every ball and every strike. I am merciless about a lot of Trump's enablers, what I call the island of misfit toys, guys like Steve Bannon and Seb Gorka and our old friend Reince.
Yep.
Who, you know, I do put Reince on the hot seat here because he was a man who had a lot of power at that moment to try to alter the terrain that we ended up founding ourselves on. So I think that I had a lot of fun doing this because I set out and I decided I'm not going to try to save myself, including myself in this for, you know, taking the heat and taking some of the blame for this. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of the ads I made over the years, I know that those things were part of a toolbox that unfortunately trained a lot of people out there, a lot of Republican voters out there, to become sort of prepped for a Trump-style candidate.
Right.
We didn't realize it at the time, but it has the unfortunate nature of being what happened. So, you know, I'm pretty merciless about myself and everything else. And I'm pretty merciless about the Democrats, too. A lot of my admirers on the left are reading through this and going, wait, there's a chapter where he blows us up.
Right, what? Right. Yeah, thought this was just all about Trump.
Yeah, you want to know why you got Trump? Do better.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly the case. And they find themselves right now having to face that proposition again for 2020 without the ability to do better. No message, no messenger who can actually come directly to the table and
right.
not take on Trump with the I hate Trump rhetoric, but to take on Trump to show just how, as you put it in the book, how much of a nickelback of presidents he really is. I love that quote. You also refer to the president as the avatar of our worst instincts and darkest desires as a nation. And on that, I could not agree with you more. In the talks that I give around the country from time to time, the one thing, you know, I set up, everybody wants to know, there's like a couch moment, Rick, where everyone's like on the couch. Okay, tell us what happened. How
right.
did we get here? Oh, my God, this is the worst. And I look at them and I give up the lay of the land. You know, people were angry. The base was frustrated. Same thing played out for
sure.
the left with Bernie Sanders. But then at the end, I look at them and I go, having said all that, you realize, of course, that we have Donald Trump because he is the best and worst reflection of you. He reflects everything that you secretly hold dear and all of this crazy stuff about, you know, the KKK and all that stuff is allowed to exist because you allow it to exist. How else do you explain, you know, after everything we know about the Access Hollywood tape, what he said right. about women, et cetera, et cetera, 52% of educated white women voted for him. So Hillary.
The upside of that is they were the ones who I think who realized it faster than almost anybody else.
Right.
Which is why Republican women have been fleeing the party, not only in voter behavior, but in many places in voter registration.
Right.
Because, you know, they were the ones who said, I'm going to hold my breath and I'm going to look past Access Hollywood because Hillary is so awful. And I'm going to look past all this other stuff because Hillary's so bad. And they waited. And I like to say this, there is no better version of Donald Trump. It's always the same guy.
Yes.
And like I said, those suburban Republican women have taken a walk on our party. And, you know, look, if we end up being the party of 55-year-old white guys with GEDs, it's pretty much game over.
Yeah, we're about 40 nanoseconds away from that.
We're working harder on that every day.
Yeah, I ran into a lot of those brothers warming up back in 2009, 2010. They weren't giving up the fight.
Like I said, once Palin crawled out of the hell mouth, it was all over.
Well, it's interesting. I want to tie two threads together. I didn't know if you had a chance to read Jonah Goldberg's piece in National Review. He has a piece that talks about when the tide comes in, and he talks about in that piece.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
How National Review, at the time it was founded, started out in this battle against what William F. Buckley called irresponsible Republicans, and he talked about. Quote, a vigorous and incorruptibly journal of conservative opinion is, dare we say it, as necessary to better living as chemistry. He goes on and goes, we begin publishing, this is with the first publication of National Review, which we know played a pivotal role in establishing and really legitimizing conservatism. He goes on, we begin publishing then with a considerable stock of experience with the irresponsible right. And that had to do with the battles that these certain conservatives were beginning to get into and emerge that were problematic.
Sure, the John Birchers back in the day.
Exactly. And so he goes on and talks about, brings it forward to Steve Bannon. And he says, back when Steve Bannon was still ginning up the alt-right and trying to turn Breitbart into a platform for it, the response from many on the right was to adopt a popular front mentality and genuflect to the popularity and fame of performance artists such as Milo Yiannopoulos and others. You, in your book, and I think this is a great little thing to sort of tie it together, you talk about the disease of Trumpism has consumed the Republican Party and put the entire conservative movement at risk. It has been hijacked by a bellowing status billionaire with poor impulse control and a profoundly superficial understanding of the world. Trump and Trumpism need a critique from the right that isn't just a long swoon and a reach for the smelling salts. Sure, I want to save the Republic from Trump and Trumpism, but I don't mind telling members of my party and movement to fuck themselves on the way there. That's sort of a real updated version of the same problem going back to 1958, 1959. Has this been sort of a constant struggle with conservatism or among conservatives over these many years?
Sure.
Because in one sense, this isn't new. And at the same time, the way this is being played out is.
Yeah, I mean, this struggle between what their desires are and what they know they should do is always present with us in politics. And look, a perfect example of this is Barack Obama. He wanted Obamacare as the single legacy item of his presidency. He then blew up his majority for almost a decade to do it. And so the tendency of overreach is always with us. And the tendency of overreach right now with the Trump folks is to think that the party's redefined itself completely. It's the Trump party only, and that's saleable in the long term. And I think that's a very, very big bet for an entire political movement, an entire political party.
Yeah, it is. It is a big bet. And it's one that I think, man, I tell you, I don't know if I'd make it. It's one of those things out there. When you look at the landscape right now, it does not get better for the GOP. And the fact that they have gone so headlong into this space the way they have, to me, is beyond troubling. I guess, what do you see recovery like? How I've been giving some thought to this in terms of the other side.
I think we're going to have a pretty hard shock. And, you know, the analogy
so there's more
I used
bottom
the other
day, to hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's more bottom. The analogy I used the other day is the fat guy who has a heart attack, and he'll do anything to get past that and to prevent another one except diet or exercise.
Right.
And I'm worried right now that there's some belief that we can just get past all this and it'll be easy and Trump will go away and we can keep the intensity of Trump's base. We can keep the intensity of Trump's, you know, most passionate supporters and not adopt Trumpism. I just don't see that pathway forward. I don't see that as a practical way of governing or trying to manage a political party in the future. And I think that the reason Trump is going to rank as one of our worst presidents is because he's made decisions that are existential to a party he doesn't really give a damn about.
Right. Right.
I mean, he's never really thought to himself, man, you know what? I really care about the party of Lincoln.
Right. No, that's never happened.
No.
No. And I don't know why people don't see that. And it surprises me that no one had the courage. And you talk about that being a huge courage deficit in the country. Why they didn't have the courage on that stage when he was at 2% among the base to knock that down. You figure between,
right,
you know, Kasich, Rubio, Bush, and even Bush with the baggage that he presumably carried coming off of, you know, his brother's campaigns and presidency, that even he would rally in that moment. And to the extent that he did, it always surprised me that no one had his back, because they were more concerned about, well, if I come off supporting Jeb Bush, that's going to give him a leg up over me in this, you know,
this
primary, and not realizing the guy he's battling is the one you should be concerned about. But they didn't take him seriously.
Well,
is that because they didn't understand the electorate or what?
Well, I think that's part of it. But I mean, the understanding of Donald Trump, they were running against a candidate, and they weren't running against the celebrity icon and the character he played on TV.
Right.
And they didn't get that. And there was a stupid calculus inside the Republican Party where I would go to supporters of Jeb, let's say, donors of Jeb, and say, listen, you guys need to get up, step up, and you need to go to town on this guy or he's going to screw you. And Jeb's people would say things like, oh, no, we're waiting for Trump to take out Marco first. And you go to Marco's people and it's like, well, first thing he's going to do is take out Jeb, and then he'll take out Cruz. And Cruz's people are like, well, we'll wait for Trump to take out Christie, Marco, and Carson, and then we've got our lane. And they all played this dumb game.
Right,
it's just so stupid. And none of them could wake up and go, wait a minute, holy hell, we're not thinking this through. We're giving this guy a free running room. And you know, I say this in the book, and I told a donor this. I'm like, and this is in August of 15. I said, you can spend $10 million now and knock this guy out. Or you can wait till he gets the nomination and spend $100 million. Or you can wait till he burns down the Republican Party and spend billions to try to get a limited government party back.
Yeah.
And he sent me a copy of that memo that I'd sent him right in the middle of last year. And his response was just, yeah, you said it. Fuck me, right?
Yeah, that kind of sums it up. Yeah, pretty much sums it up. Yeah, there you are. There you are. Well, Rick Wilson, he's the man, folks. He is someone who has been on the inside and as well as the outside, knows really where we are right now in this sort of national crisis when it comes to leadership and the party and the presidency. His new book, Everything Trump Touches Dies, A Republican Strategist Gets Real, and he does. He does, people.
I'm real.
About the worst president ever. This book is a good one, folks. I got my copy. Go out and get yours for sure. Rick, it's a real treat having you on, man. And
thank
taking
you,
a little
brother.
Time with the Man
it.
Of Steel. We really appreciate it.
I will talk to you again soon.
You got it. You take
thank
care.
Thank you, sir. Have
all
a
right.
great one.
All right, bye-bye. Folks. Also, remember, you can catch us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. You know the good juicy places you like to go hot out. And you can find me on Twitter @MichaelSteel. This is Man of Steel. We'll be back next time with more good stuff.